Talking History. On News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, how Newfoundland became the 10th province to become part of Canada, the Irish priest who was an eyewitness to the Spanish Civil War, the Silk Roads and how they changed the world, John Henry Newman, his legacy, and whether he was snubbed when he became a saint. And to end the show, we'll explore the contribution of the Irish Thoracic Society to Irish healthcare. Now, last week, we looked at the life, legacy and legend of Giuseppe Garibaldi and how he became an international icon in the 19th century. And the week before, we looked at a century of Irish foreign policy. And if you want to listen back to any of those shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. We begin with how Newfoundland became the 10th province to become part of Canada. A new book challenges popular notions that those who voted against Confederation in Canada in 1869 and for Union in 1948 were uninformed and gullible. It argues that voters fully understood the issues at stake in both cases, and women became instrumental in determining the final outcome, voting for Canada in 1948, believing it provided the best opportunities for their children. The story has now been told in a new book, Where Once They Stood, Newfoundland's Rocky Road Towards Confederation. It's published in paperback by the University of Regina Press and costs about €24. The authors are Raymond B. Blake and Melvin Baker, and I'm delighted to welcome Raymond Blake to the show tonight. You're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Can we talk about the constitutional talks that were taking place in Quebec and elsewhere in the 1860s? What were they discussing?
Well, you know, a lot of people were realizing, as we know, the 1860s, the 1850s was the age of nation building around the world. Quite often in common textbooks, it's referred to the age of nation building. So people in British North America, as it was called before it became Canada in 1867, were also looking at, you know, how do we sort of move from small colonies, pretty much separate and independent within the British Empire, to something that would be more significant and probably could expand across all of North America, north of what is the United States.
And why then did the why was the decision taken, given that there was this move towards nation building? Why was the decision then taken not to go along with Confederation?
Well, there were a variety of reasons. The two colonies in British North America that refused to join was Prince Edward Island, a small island province, and Newfoundland, which became eventually Newfoundland and Labrador, the most easterly part of British North America. Two islands stayed out, and they stayed out for a variety of reasons. Many had to do with the ideas that were presented to them by the mainland colonies of Ontario and Quebec, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. So they decided to stay out. PEI came in a short time later in 1873. Newfoundland stayed out for 80 years.
Now, in the popular stories of this, it's usually put down to a split between Catholics and Protestants, or down to a victory for prejudice, or because the voters were uneducated or too poor, or, you know, too stupid to know what was going on. And this book challenges those assumptions and I suppose negative perceptions of the whole thing.
Yes, indeed. You know, it's always quite common for those who disagree with the outcome of a particular vote, will say, if only the voters were as smart as I was or as we are, then they would have made the right choice. And for a very long time, the Confederation debates in Newfoundland, and they raged for a very long time, you know, really from the 1860s through to the 1940s. And during this time, you know, there were two main events in what I call, or what we call in the book, Confederation moments. And quite often, those, if we could use the word losers, who lost the debate in 1869, said, oh, if people were smarter, if they weren't so stupid, if there weren't so many uneducated, incompetent voters, they would have done the right thing and voted for Confederation. The same sort of argument is made in 1948, 49. And in both cases, the elites in Newfoundland wanted in 1869 to join, and in 1948, they wanted to stay out. And in both cases, the elites lost.
Is it the case that the Irish presence in Newfoundland played a part in the rejection because some of the Irish were suspicious of the British connection?
That is an argument that's been frequently made, and there is some validity in it. But what is really interesting, in both 1869 and in 1948, the Irish, or the Catholic, and of course many Catholics who are Irish, was split. And not only were the Irish and the Catholics opposed to Confederation in 1869, so were many Protestants and Church of England and United Church or Methodists. So to say that it was Catholics who were opposed or made or influenced the outcome was so important is really a simplified version, both in 1869 and in 1948.
So let's talk about the 1940s then and the lead up to the vote. What role did women play in the outcome then?
But you know, we don't have exit polls as we do today, but one of the things that is really interesting about the 1940s that women could vote. They could vote in Newfoundland from the 1920s. And even in the first election, we know that a large number of women, as soon as they were eligible to vote, did in fact vote. And one of the major determining factors, we think, in 1948, is that one of the big issues was, what role is the state going to play in people's lives? And as you probably know, Patrick, Newfoundland was and is still really one of the poorest provinces in Canada. It was one of the poorer parts of British North America. And one of the issues that was pivotal in the 1940s was a group of people wanting to join Canada said Newfoundland had never been able to provide a decent living for its residents. And one of the big issues coming out of the Second World War was social programs, or what we call in the book social citizenship. And this was about family allowances, old age pension, running water, social amenities for people. And they were sadly lacking in Newfoundland. Of course, they had been instituted in Great Britain a few years before, in Australia and Canada. And the proponents of Confederation said these social programs, this new relationship with the state, can give you a better life. The Confederates really used those arguments and appealed to mothers and saying, look, as a new province of Canada, you can be like British citizens, have social welfare programs, family allowances for your children. Same as happening in Australia. But they weren't coming to Newfoundland. Newfoundland couldn't afford them on their own. We will give them to you. And one of the major proponents of Confederation would tour around the country and pull a young boy or a young girl, or probably a number of children, up on the stage and say, Johnny, how many brothers do you have? And Johnny would say, I have 8. And Joseph Smallwood, who was the leader, say, well, do you know that your mother will get, if you join Canada, $8 for each one of your brothers and sisters? That adds up to, you know, $64 a month, which was real money in 1940s, and he would do that in community after community. And mothers quite frequently came out to those rallies. And certainly we believe they were swayed by that. And a number of them were writing letters to the editor and sort of promoting Confederation, saying, this is a good deal.
Why was there a backlash afterwards then when there was the successful vote? Because it seems strange that when they voted against it in the 19th century, people were saying, oh, the voters were gullible and that they were duped. And then they vote for it in the 20th century and the same thing is said.
Exactly. And you know, the losing side, if I could use that word loosely, frequently had to find an explanation. And they saw it in Newfoundland was then and now literacy rates are low. And there were large numbers of formerly uneducated people, didn't have much beyond grade 3 or 4. And there were a group of people who thought that the nation that had been created by the people in and around the capital city, and it was really interesting, Patrick, if you know the Newfoundland Island, it's triangular shaped, and on the east coast is where the capital city of St. John's is. People around the capital city voted for independence. Their idea of nation was probably quite well established. They had a railway, they had hospitals they had access to. The further you move away from the capital city, the less there was in terms of infrastructure, hospitals, schools. And so these people really never had a sense of attachment to the nation that those in the urban centers did. And so there was a real split between the urban centers and the rural areas. Quite often the elites in the rural, in the urban areas said, it's our God-given right. We've always managed this province, this country, and we've done a damn fine job. But of course, they did for their own group, for the people outside who were completely disconnected from that. They rebelled against the elite. And in most popular uprisings, it is the elites which are challenged and taken down. And in this particular case, the elites were not very happy. And for example, the Catholic bishop, Roach, was very opposed to Confederation. He was afraid of denominational education. Newfoundland had a system of denominational education since the 1830s, which gave the religious orders complete control of the school system and provided the money to run the school system. And they were worried, the Catholics were in particular, that this would come unraveled in a new relationship that Smallwood himself promoted as a British Union. And of course, the word British Union to many Irish in Newfoundland had certain connotations which weren't particularly favorable to their outlook.
Okay, well, it's a fascinating story, and I think so many interesting parallels to other things that happened elsewhere in the world that I think our listeners will be thinking of during that discussion. The book is called Where Once They Stood, Newfoundland's Rocky Road Towards Confederation. It's published in paperback by the University of Regina Press and costs about €24. The authors are Raymond Blake and Melvin Baker. And Raymond, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History, on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. In July 1936, an army-led coup against the democratically elected Republican government ushered in the Spanish Civil War. Father Alexander McCabe was rector of the Irish College in Salamanca when General Franco seized power a few months later and established his general headquarters in the medieval city. Historian Tim Fanning uses McCabe's diaries to provide a fascinating account of life in Spain before, during and after the war, as well as McCabe's memories of growing up in Ireland at a time of momentous change. The book is called The Salamanca Diaries, Father McCabe and the Spanish Civil War. It's published in hardback by Merriam and costs €19.95. The author is Tim Fanning. And Tim, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Well, first, congratulations on your productivity, because you have an enviable production rate. But it's a fascinating story, and you get incredible insights not only into what's going on into Spain, but also into Ireland and into people like General Ona Duffy and the Blue Shirts.
That's right. I first became interested in McCabe when I was considering writing a book about the Irish Brigade and O'Duffy. And I started looking at Father McCabe's diaries, which are in the National Library in Dublin. And I was initially interested in his reflections on the war because I knew he was in Salamanca when Franco set up his GHQ there. But as I started reading the diaries, I became more and more interested in the man himself. He was an incredibly erudite man. He was very shrewd in terms of picking up the key elements of a person's character. And I just found it fascinating. So I just more and more as I read these books, my own book became more about McCabe the man than what I initially intended.
And he did have some wonderful turns of phrases. For example, he described Franco as being perhaps a bit too small and stodgy to be a dictator.
That's right. I mean, when he first saw Franco, he was quite impressed by him. He saw him in the Plaza Mayor in Salamanca during one of these great ceremonials in the early days of the war, and he was quite impressed. But later on, when he actually had a meeting, or he went to a meeting with Paddy Belton, and he met him in person, he was very unimpressed, and he although he was an Irish, he was an Irish Catholic priest in Spain during the Civil War, and his sympathies obviously were pro-nationalist, but he was quite unimpressed by the time he came back to Ireland by the whole by all of that he had seen during the war. I mean, I think it had a profound effect upon him, and he was certainly. The bloodshed that I saw, I mean, it really left his mark on him. I think when he got back to Ireland in the 50s, he was quite traumatised, I think, by what he'd seen.
And there's that tragic kind of end story where he's suffering from alcoholism and mental health issues, and it is a sad... going back earlier then to the Civil War, he was one of the first chaplains to Ona Duffy's Irish Brigade. What did he think of O'Duffy? And because he had an interesting relationship and tried to persuade him to stay.
He'd been a student, McCabe. He came from Cavan, and he'd been a student in Salamanca, in the Irish College in Salamanca. I think he went there in, just after the First World War. And then he'd been asked to become vice-rector of the college. And he went back to Spain in 1930. And then he became rector in 1935. So he was in Salamanca when the Irish Brigade came over, and they were in Cáceres in Extremadura. And the chaplain, the official chaplain to the Irish Brigade, asked him to come down to Cáceres to help with confessions and so on. And he was initially quite impressed by O'Duffy and the brigade. And, you know, I think he very much saw the Irish Brigade in terms of the long standing tradition of Irish soldiers serving on the continent and the historical links, particularly military, between Ireland and Spain. But as time went on, he really began to become disillusioned with the Irish Brigade, and he had no time for O'Duffy. I mean, he thought O'Duffy's reasons for coming to Spain were purely political, and he thought he was very ignorant about the situation, and he was dismissive of the fact that O'Duffy was fussy about the local food and that he didn't make any effort to speak Spanish. So by the time, you know, after about 6 months, the relationship between them was very poor. But that said, he didn't want to see the Irish Brigade return to Ireland because he thought it reflected very, very badly on the national reputation. So he tried, when O'Duffy finally decided that he'd been treated very badly by Franco and the Nationalist High Command, and decided that he was going to bring the brigade home, McCabe was very much involved in trying to persuade him to stay, and tried to patch together a deal. And there's notes about this in the National Library, but eventually, of course, O'Duffy went home.
He had some interesting people in the Irish College with him, because the German embassy was housed there and the Nazi press and propaganda department. And McCabe believed, and possibly with good reason, that they were bugging everything.
That's right. Obviously, when Franco decided to set up his headquarters in Salamanca, you had the Nationalist generals, all the senior officers coming to Salamanca. You had the Germans coming over. You had all the journalists from all around the world coming over. So there was very little space. So he tried desperately to... I mean, the students of the Irish College had been evacuated. They had actually been on holiday in the north of Spain, in Asturias, in the early days of the war. And they'd been evacuated by British destroyer in August 1936. And McCabe had been in Ireland, but he came back to make sure that... to look after the Irish College and to look after the summer house that the Irish College had in Asturias. But he tried desperately to prevent people from using the Irish College, from requisitioning it. But obviously he couldn't prevent that. And among those that used the Irish College were Falange militias. And then later on, the German embassy set up their offices in there. And they had they had the press and propaganda department upstairs, and McCabe was given a tour of it, and there's pictures of Hitler on the wall. And he talks in his diaries about being a bit paranoid, because he'd have parties in his own room in the Irish College with acquaintances in Salamanca. And I think on one occasion, somebody dared the other, after quite a bit of Irish whiskey, I'd imagine, one member of the party dared the other to give the communist salute. And he later said in his diaries he was worried that the Germans were eavesdropping, because they had all sorts of technical equipment for bugging equipment, probably. Yeah. So there are several anecdotes like that in the diaries, which are fascinating.
Now, as you say, some fascinating insights in the diaries. They're a brilliant historical resource. There could have been a lot more, because he destroyed some of his diaries in 1945. Why did he do that?
Well, that's the big question. The diaries that exist, there's diaries from the 1920s when he was a curate in London, which are quite interesting as well. But the diaries covering the war, the Civil War, are from the early part of the war, 36, 37, the beginning of 38, I believe. But then he destroyed the diaries from 39 and those that covered the Second World War. His explanation, which he wrote in later diaries, was that he'd seen too much and that he'd got disillusioned with all this scribbling. And he wrote millions of words. I think that there are a couple of explanations. One is that I think he suffered from depression and he had severe mood swings. And also perhaps there were things contained in the diaries that would have incriminated him in the eyes of the Francoist regime post-Second World War that he mightn't have wanted discovered.
And he hated the Nazis saw them as the scourge of God.
Yes, he got on reasonably well with some of those that were in the Irish College during the Civil War, some of the German officials. But he hated the fact that there were these commemorations. For instance, there was a commemoration in the Irish College. The Nazi Party in Salamanca organised a commemoration for marking the anniversary of Hitler's coming to power in Germany, and he found that very, very difficult, and he wrote about he writes in his diaries about how he saw the Nazis as threatening European civilization. So I mean, even though he was there's quite a bit in his diaries that you can imagine about the threat of communism and during the Civil War, and he was, he would have been pro-nationalist to an extent. He was particularly horrified by the Nazis and also by some of the things that the nationalists were doing.
And a sad later career, and wasn't particularly treated well by his bishop when he returned home.
No, I mean he had a fairly serious drink problem by the time he returned to Ireland in 1950. The Irish College never reopened, actually. The Irish bishops decided that they didn't want to reopen it, and it was handed over to the Spanish government. But when he got back, he had a severe drink problem. And at that time in the Diocese of Kilmore, the way the bishop would treat errant priests was by sending them to the most remote parishes in the diocese. And I think after having spent most of his adult life mixing with, diplomats and academics, it was very difficult for him to adapt to that kind of life back home.
Okay, well, another brilliant book by Tim Fanning. It's called The Salamanca Diaries, Father McCabe and the Spanish Civil War. Published in hardback by Merriam. It costs €19.95. And Tim, thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book brings together 80 leading scholars from across the globe to situate the ancient Silk Roads against the landscapes that defined them, revealing the raw materials that they produced, the means of travel that were employed to traverse them, and the communities that were shaped by them. The book is called Silk Roads, Peoples, Cultures, Landscapes. It's published in hardback by Thames and Hudson and costs £49.95 sterling, so about €55. The editor is Susan Whitfield. And Susan, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It is a beautiful collection of essays, and it's a beautiful job that Thames and Hudson have done, because there are stunning maps here. You get images of the artefacts, you get a sense of the landscapes, and you really get a sense of what these Silk Roads were like, what they were about, and where they were.
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I very much wanted to show the Silk Road not as a linear narrative, but very much show the complexity of it. And it's, of course, about the movement and interaction of peoples as much as it is about the movement and interaction of goods travelling along these roads. And the landscapes are very important for that. The landscapes are important in determining the routes for the raw materials to make the goods that were traded, for affecting the life of the peoples along the Silk Road. So we wanted to show a selection of the landscapes from across the Silk Road, from north to south and east and west, the deserts, the mountains, the rivers, and the sea, and also show objects alongside objects that emerged out of these landscapes.
And it's interesting that the book is deliberately titled Silk Roads, because you get that sense that it's not just a single road, that there's so much, it's a complex network going on.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the Silk Road is often presented, or the Silk Road is often presented as this linear route going between China and Rome. And that's even more so now with the whole importance of China and its place in the world, and it's pushing its Belt Road initiative as a modern day Silk Road. But in fact, the Silk Road wasn't really about China and Rome. It was about all the places in between that were just as important, if not more so. And it wasn't just about silk. It was about many, many different raw materials and goods that traveled north, south, east, west, by sea, by land, all across Afro-Eurasia. And I should say, Africa, especially the east coast and north of Africa, is a very important part of this story, which is often also left out of the traditional Silk Road narrative.
Yes, it's fascinating that it's a much broader map than I would have thought, because it includes areas in Africa, Central Asia is important, that it spans the globe in a way that I hadn't thought.
Indeed. Well, you know, it wasn't really a Silk Road, or indeed Silk Roads. This is just a modern term that we use to describe a time in the pre-modern world where there were global connections, many global connections. And those connections went between all the different kingdoms and empires that existed over 1,500 years from roughly the first millennium and up until 1400-1500. And Africa, indeed, was an essential part of that story. The Aksumite kingdom in what is now Ethiopia in East Africa, the first few centuries of our era, was a major sea trading kingdom. And in fact, at the time, it was described as one of the four most important empires of the world, the others being Rome, China, and Persia.
So talk to me about the kinds of things then that were being transmitted, because it seems to be everything from silk to slaves. It seems to have led to changes in fashion. It had implications for religion, but also for science, that this was more than just the transmission of goods.
Yeah, well, of course, goods are taken by people. And so people are just as much the starring role in this story as the goods. And people take with them a whole lot of cultural baggage, their tangible and intangible cultural heritage, their languages, their religions, their music, their scripts, their dance, and much more. And when you get these people coming into new cultures, and there are also, of course, migrations of people throughout this whole period, you get this interaction which results in new ideas, new technologies, new goods. So, yeah, there were a great variety of goods taken along the Silk Road, as you said. Often silk is now written out of the story or downplayed, but silk was a very, very important material and a very important technology. And we mustn't forget that it wasn't only goods, it was the technologies that came along with them. And so silk technology, raising silkworms and raising trees, mulberry trees to feed the silkworms, travelled alongside the silk itself and gradually took root all the way across Eurasia, right to the borders of Europe by the 8th century in southern Spain. So we see silk indeed as throughout the whole history of the Silk Road as being very important. But as you said, it's only one of the many, many other goods that are travel along, including, as you mentioned, slaves, which are a very, very important part of the story. And I should say something else that's often forgotten, but horses are incredibly important for the trade and economics of the Silk Road, and also for the military life, of course, of the Silk Road.
In 2014, a section of the routes were designated a World Heritage Site by UNESCO. And in some ways, that's a good thing because it's recognising their significance. Although I suppose it could encourage people to again think of it in narrower terms rather than being much broader and much more ambitious.
Well, I think UNESCO went about it in quite an interesting way because they spent a lot of time in consultation. And in the end, they decided to concentrate on corridors going across the whole of Eurasia, or Asia anyway. And so the first 2014 nomination was corridor that went through China, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. So each corridor will encompass several countries, one or two or more countries. And the corridors don't have to join up. They might be, and they might be north-south, so they might challenge those traditional ideas that Silk Road. So I think the UNESCO concept, if you're going to do it at all, is a good thing. And of course, hopefully, it will bring many sites that are lesser known, especially those in Central Asia and places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, bring these to the forefront or to more attention, and mean that resources are spent on them.
Do you think the Silk Roads contributed to the development of civilizations? Was it evidence that migration and immigration was of benefit to societies?
So relevant to today's world, I think, which is why, as a historian, I believe we should all study history, because we all learn from the past about the present. And everything you learn about the Silk Road shows that migration, whether forced or voluntary, or the movement of peoples in other ways, whether it was people, princesses sent off to marry foreign rulers or whatever, but especially migrations of populations, were enormously important for the development of the Silk Road, and greatly enriched their receiving societies, and greatly enriched the products that they came out with, the languages, the cultures, the religions, and indeed the economics, if you're just looking at it from a practical point of view. So I think from a personal point of view, this is one of the reasons I study the Silk Road, is that it gives me the opportunity to look at this mixtures and interactions of people, and to, if you like, celebrate. And that's what I'm trying to do in this book, and I hope that it comes across, to celebrate the diversity of the past and how it informs our present world.
Okay, well, Susan, thanks so much for joining us tonight. The book is called Silk Roads, Peoples, Cultures, Landscapes. It's published in hardback by Thames and Hudson and costs about €55. The editor is Susan Whitfield. And Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. When John Henry Newman was canonized a saint late last year, it encouraged us to look again at his life and remarkable legacy, and particularly the connections with our own country. And those connections are explored in a wonderful new biography, Newman, A Short Biography. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications and costs €9.95. The author is Michael Collins. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
It's very interesting that although there was a lot of acrimony when John Henry Newman converted from the Anglican Church halfway through his life in the 19th century, that even though there was that tension at the time, there doesn't seem to be any tension now, because for his canonization ceremony, there was a big delegation from the Church of England.
That's right. Actually, I was lucky enough to go over to Rome for the canonization on the 13th of October. And I must say, I was really taken with the whole way the things were organized over there. The British were extraordinarily proud of Newman, and they were very well organized. And I was really impressed by the amount of people who turned up, not just from the Catholic Church, which you'd expect, but the very large delegation who came from the Anglican Church, led, of course, by Prince Charles. And that was really, you know, to have the second most senior member of the royal household to attend a Catholic ceremony like that was extraordinary. But the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, was supposed to go, but the date of canonization had only been set on the 1st of July by Pope Francis, so he wasn't able to change a prior engagement, but he sent three bishops in instead, which I suppose three bishops equals one Archbishop of Canterbury. But there were lots of people who turned up from the Anglican tradition, and as I say, for the Catholics, you know, they were naturally very proud and chuffed, because Newman for them is a really important character. I remember, you know, when I was young, I'm 60 now, I'm 59, years ago, when I'd hear people talking about Cardinal Newman, it was almost as if he'd only died a couple of years earlier. So his memory in Ireland is pretty strong as well.
And it's interesting, he was instrumental in the founding of the university that became University College Dublin, UCD, and set up the Literary and Historical Society, the LNH, the Great Debating Society. But in his own lifetime, it wasn't a great success in his time in Dublin.
Oh, no, the Dublin experience, I think he probably looked back and in disappointment when it was all finished off, because what had happened was, putting this in its historical context, was that in the 1800s, the British Crown changed its view towards Catholicism and allowed a lot of, many of the prohibitions which had been there for so long were kind of eased off through a series of governments and prime ministers. And in 1829, in the Irish experience, we had, of course, Catholic Emancipation, which allowed for loosening of the practice of the Catholic faith in Ireland. And things were changing anyway. And in 1850, the British hierarchy was restored in England. And at the same time, the Irish bishops had a synod in Thurles, during which they decided that they'd set up a university, because there really was only the Queen's Universities, Trinity, etc., which were available. And although Catholics were not prohibited at that stage from entering, they wanted to set up their own kind of Catholic university. They didn't have anybody really of equality, because keep in mind that Catholic education was very meagre in the first part of the 19th century. We didn't have any of the great universities, and the bishops wanted to set up one which would be their own. So in 1851-52, Paul Cullen, who just come to Armagh, the Archbishop of Armagh, approached Newman, who was, if you like, he'd only converted and become a priest a few years earlier, 5-6 years earlier. And he knew him as Oxford educated, a graduate of Trinity, a fellow of Oriel. And he was already, quite a respectable author. So he thought, well, this would be a very good chap to come over to Dublin and set up the university. So Newman couldn't resist the challenge, because he'd a little bit of vanity as well. So he accepted the challenge. He came over, but he found the whole experience very difficult, because shortly after he'd arrived in May of 1852, Cullen became Archbishop of Dublin, and he's transferred from Armagh down to Dublin. And Newman thought, oh, this will be great, because I'll have his support. But in actual fact, Newman wasn't able to count on Cullen's help, because Cullen was now aiming to set up a kind of a Roman Dublin in his own diocese. He set up 20 parishes over the period that he's in Dublin, introduced 40 religious orders. And keep in mind, the religious habit had been outlawed for so long. And then suddenly, I'd say it was probably like being at the carnival in those days in Dublin, all these kind of elaborate, colourful religious habits appearing all over the place. And so he was interested in doing that and setting up his own seminary, which is very successful. So the idea of having a recently converted Protestant vicar telling him what to do and how to set up a university didn't really appeal within his diocese, because the bishops were at that stage, I don't know if they still are, extremely territorial. And as I said, there's also a little bit of, I think there's a bit of snobbery involved. And Newman was given the task not only of trying to set up the college with not much help, but he also had to raise money for it. So he went around the bishops of the Diocese of Ireland, and in his diary he notes on one occasion that they all seemed to subsist on a diet of mutton, and he had a much better reception among the sisters and the convents of the country. But as I say, the university really wasn't a great success in his day. He only had a handful of entrants. When he set up one of his, I think the first pupil was grandson of Daniel O'Connell. And after about 5-6 years, it kind of fizzled out and they had to let it lapse. And in fact, it didn't get off the ground again until 1880. But at the same time, I have to say, without Newman, there's no way that we would have got our college, UCD, off the ground, because, he put himself on the line to try and do as best he could. And his effort eventually proved that it would bear fruit.
And that's why I know a number of people that I was talking to back then were really kind of offended that UCD wasn't going to go to the canonization ceremony, because whatever about UCD being a secular university, you should still recognize and be involved in an event honoring your founder.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't know the background about that, but it certainly was very embarrassing among the Irish delegation because there were so few. I believe the Minister of Education and the Vice Provost of UCD eventually agreed to go the week of the canonization. But, I mean, it was very embarrassing because, as I say, the British just sent everybody. The Provost of Oriel College was there. Everybody pitched up. And the Romans, the Vatican, gave them a fantastic entertainment for the few days. There were seminars, concerts, all sorts of things. So, unfortunately, I think we shot ourselves in the foot. But, look, hopefully they learned the lesson. It was just maybe a misunderstanding. But I did meet the British ambassador to the Holy See, and she did say that it wasn't for lack of trying on her part that she tried to get through to the Irish government and explain the importance of the event and how big it was going to be. But, look, we missed the party and these things happen.
And Newman is, of course, recognised around the world as being a great educator, and his lectures that became the book, The Idea of a University, that's widely read, and it shapes so many people's views of what a good university should be.
Absolutely, yes. I was surprised because when I set about writing the book, I wanted to write almost like a pamphlet because, you know, his writings were enormous, and I haven't even still read a lot of his writings because it's just too many of them. But I've got much more interested since I've started investigating him a little bit more. And I had a connection with University Church because I was baptized there on the Green. So I've always had an interest in his writing. And I remember reading an extract of, I think it's called Islands of the North when I was in school. And I think many of my age group will have had to do that for the leaving. But his work on the idea of the university not only was, but is seminal. And it's interesting, his view of university is that it's to prepare people to be educated for all spheres of life. Whereas nowadays, unfortunately, the university is seen as a place which prepares you to get a job. And they're two entirely different approaches. And the American view of university education, actually even the secular American university system, is much closer to John Henry Newman's idea, whereby you would have a good smattering of knowledge of every field. And if you want to do something like, you know, the way very often you see reports of universities saying they've done a study and they've discovered that X, Y, Z, whatever, he would say, no, that type of thing should be done in an academy, which is set up specifically for the preparation of one discipline, but that the university itself should try and educate you in as many things as possible. Now, unfortunately, the university system, both in Ireland and in Britain, has changed quite a deal in the last century, and it's become very narrow. And that's why, unfortunately, so many people are in just one field and not maybe broadly educated in a wider field.
Okay, well, Michael, my thanks for joining us tonight to talk about the life and the contribution to world education of John Henry Newman. The book is called Newman, A Short Biography. It's published in paperback by Messenger Publications and costs €9.95. The author, Michael Collins. And Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patrick. All the best. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History, and I'm delighted to be joined now by Professor Mairsh Fitzgerald to talk to me about the history of the Irish Thoracic Society. And a new book has been published on the work of this multidisciplinary respiratory medicine organisation and the pivotal role it has played in campaigning for the improvement of the health of its patients with respiratory diseases in Ireland over the past number of decades, seven decades indeed. The book is called A History of the Irish Thoracic Society. It's written by Mairsh Fitzgerald, Anthony O'Regan and Suzanne McCormick, published by the Society, and it costs €50. And Mairsh, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Can we talk about the society and its foundation? Because from the very beginning, it was involved in a major campaign to do with TB.
That's right. It was originally founded in 1946. And the chief impetus for it was the terrible scourge of tuberculosis with very high mortality. There were 4,000 people per annum dying. It had a huge social stigma. Families didn't want to reveal that a family member had the disease. It was the era of sanatoria, and also was an era when there was no treatment. And so the Irish Tuberculosis Society was set up by people who were interested in it, including some very famous names, also the heads of various sanatoria that were scattered around the country.
And you mentioned some famous names, and people will be familiar with Noel Brown, maybe Kathleen Lynn, Dorothy Stafford Price, you know, all people we've talked about on the show over the years. And sometimes there was conflict between some of these members, for example, between Noel Brown and James Deeney, who was the chief medical advisor for the Department of Health.
Yeah, there certainly was a fractious relationship between the two, who were both members of the Irish Tuberculosis Society, fully paid up, but that didn't prevent them from having a very difficult relationship. And Deeney had come as a fresh new medical advisor in the Department of Health, and he brought in sweeping changes that were very progressive, and he had done a lot of work to legislatively with his minister, who was Dr. Ryan, a medical doctor as well in the Fianna Fáil government, and he had laid the groundwork for a lot of sanatorium building, some of which came to naught, unfortunately. But the chief clashes with Noel Brown occurred when Noel Brown, on his first day in the Dáil, elected as Minister for Health at an impossibly young age, marches into the Department of Health and starts an entirely new regime that had little respect for any of the previous achievements. So within a short period of time, there was poor chemistry between the two of them. And eventually Noel Brown decided to clean out everything, and he more or less enforced that Deeney would be sidelined into the Medical Research Council of Ireland to do a project on TB, and took him out of all decision making. He also got rid of a number of other members of the Irish Thoracic Society who were the TB specialists in the Department of Health. So it was a very fractious relationship, and both men have written their books with somewhat different perspectives on the rightness of the positions each of them took up.
And what do you think was the ultimate reason for the battle against TB to have succeeded? Was it the role of drugs? Was it the role of different programs? What worked?
Well, it was a mixture of things. TB mortality, although horrible in the 1940s at the foundation, had been coming down progressively. So that's been attributed to better nutrition and better housing, social factors. But the big impetus that came from Noel Brown particularly was he speeded up everything. And he had a wonderful windfall, which was the equivalent of our lotto now, the Irish Hospital Sweepstakes money, which was intended to bail out the ailing Dublin voluntary hospitals of all of their debts. Many of them were in considerable debt. He got not only the interest, but the entire capital. So he marched into the cabinet office with more money than any of the other ministers. And when his plans were set out and they said, how are you going to pay for that? He said, it's going to come from the hospital sweepstakes money. He had one other great advantage as well, and that he had powers undreamt of by a minister for health nowadays, which was he could change the function of any hospital in the country, which he duly did. And he cleared out a number of have hospitals around the country, hospitals in Limerick, hospitals in Castlereagh and County Roscommon, an extraordinary event, and made them into chest hospitals. And he appointed chest surgeons. And as a result, in the 3 years he was minister, from 48 to 51, he had doubled the number of sanatorium beds where people were sequestered away. Now, the drugs did come in then, and of course they totally accelerated the process. But he had got it off to a fast start, and the drugs did the rest, because within a short period of time, many of the sanatoria were past their sell-by date.
There are some wonderful chapters on the later era of the society and the campaign for better lung health and campaigning against lung disease. And you see new labs opening and new lung X-ray imaging techniques. But what fascinated me about the book was the role the society played in the campaign for cleaner air and for a tobacco-free society. And these were campaigns that had a huge impact on Irish society and, you could say, on world society.
Absolutely. That's been a campaigning role for the society right throughout its existence. Cleaner air, the crucial effect of the quality of air on the prevalence and incidence of lung disease and its severity is crucial in this whole area. And so Micheál Martin's introduction of the smoking ban, Mary Harney's banning of smoky coal in the urban metropolitan areas, all of these stressed the importance of good legislation. But what led up to that legislation was the influence of organisations like the Irish Thoracic Society in relentlessly campaigning for this, particularly one of our members and a president later on, Dr. Luke Clancy, who was in the vanguard of this. And that remains so today, because the problems are still there of dangerous workplaces and smoky coal now in the smaller towns around the country.
And is that the future direction of the society then, to continue this fight?
Well, absolutely. It'll continue that campaigning role. It's produced position papers and documents. It's been to the Dáil, to select committees. This is a key part of it. But of course, the other side of the Irish Thoracic Society is promoting better care, better diagnostics, better facilities, better support, and multidisciplinary care, where people are looked after not only by doctors and paediatricians and surgeons, but also by physiotherapists, specialist nurses, and respiratory physiologists. It's a team effort.
And is also involved in things like cystic fibrosis, sleep disorders. It has a wide-ranging remit.
Absolutely. Cystic fibrosis, of course, one of the dominant features of it is lung disease, although there are many other problems with nutrition and so on. And so there are centres around the country. I was particularly involved in cystic fibrosis, setting up adult units. And the sleep disorders during sleep, respiratory disorders during sleep, that is was a new science introduced by Professor Walter McNicholas in the mid-1980s. And now there are sleep laboratories around the country for the real problem of sleep apnea. In other words, ceasing to breathe or breathing inadequately during sleep.
So the sense you get from the book is how one society, by taking this important role and taking on an important campaigning role, can actually lead to major breakthroughs across so many areas.
Oh yes, absolutely. It's not only campaigning to get better legislation, but also campaigning for facilities and introducing the advances in technology to the patient, because often there's a lag between a new drug, a new technique, getting to the patients, and accelerating that is part of the advocacy role of the organisation.
So the society has played a major role in making sure we all breathe better and more safely in Ireland.
yes, and will continue to do so ad infinitum.
And will continue to do so. My thanks to Professor Murch Fitzgerald for joining me to talk about a wonderful history of a society that people may not be familiar with, but it has played an important role over the past seven decades. In fact, in its eighth decade now, 74 years ago, founded. The authors are Murch Fitzgerald, Anthony O'Regan and Suzanne McCormick. It's called A History of the Irish Thoracic Society. And Murch, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Well, a fascinating look at the history of their Irish Thoracic Society and their contribution to Irish healthcare. And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll be looking back on one of my favourite shows of the year, on the life and legacy of Jenny Wise Power. And we'll debate her contribution to Irish politics and society and why she has been neglected in Irish history for so long. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.